The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So I hope you enjoyed that metta. I think, you know, the phrase about finding forgiveness for the inevitable harms we bring to one another, it's both forgiving and being forgiven. And, you know, we don't hear a lot about forgiveness in the insight tradition. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about forgiveness a lot more, but actually in as I understand it from a piece I read quite a few years ago, that that forgiveness in the Theravadin tradition is the complete absence of ill will, that it doesn't mean that you have to reconcile with a person or engage with a person, that once you've abandoned all wishes for that individual to be harmed or to suffer in any way, that that essentially is forgiveness. And I've always thought that was that was a bar that was low enough that I can really imagine myself working with it, because it doesn't require that sort of reconciliation. And there may be times where it is, you know, not at all safe to engage with another person. I'm going to talk about this a little bit later when I read something that Larry Yang wrote, but I do think it's the recognition that it is inevitable that we harm one another through our, mostly through our ignorance, and that we would like to be forgiven and to forgive. And I think it really is something that, especially with the offenders, is really meaningful to them. So metta, usually translated as loving kindness, is really this feeling of friendliness, benevolence. The early texts talk about it as not having ill will. And it's just a wish for the welfare of all, including oneself. So it's a sort of lovely, benevolent kind of feeling of wishing all beings well. And it was initially, as I think many of you know, it was taught as an antidote to fear. That the story is that there were monks doing a rain retreat, and the Buddha told them to go into this forest, and they were sure that there were tree spirits and all kinds of spirits in the forest that really didn't want them there. And so they left and they came back and they asked the Buddha for a reassignment. And he taught them this practice and sent it back. And he said, if you are completely without harm for others, they would have no reason to fear you and no reason to harm you. So it's really this idea that when we are completely harmless, we don't give others reasons to fear us, which of course is not to say there's no guarantee that we will not be harmed, but it's a wonderful it's wonderful to think when you're engaging with someone that this person has nothing to fear from me. I will not harm this person. And I used to, years ago when I worked on the AIDS line, people would often call me and be really, really angry about something that was going wrong in the system. And they'd be just furious. And it was not something that I could fix, but I often thought, you know, I am such a safe person to be angry with, because there are just no constant, I won't retaliate. I wish you well. I understand that the systems are just awful. And I would just feel really good knowing that this person could vent completely and I was a safe person to vent with. And, that's really helped me in a lot of ways, very, even a little more personal many, many years ago. And my son was in high school and everyone got along with all his teachers, his friends, and he would just get so angry with me, like angry beyond belief with me. And I went to see a counselor about this with him. And the counselor said, so you're the only person he gets really angry with. And I said, that's right. And he said, so I guess you're the safe person in his life. And you know, that just changed everything. And I have passed this on to numerous other moms and dads who have had, who just feel so terrible because their kids are just totally acting out toward them. And sometimes it's a sign of safety that you are not going to harm them. It's really safe for them to express this anger. And I think that's what metta is, that we can sort of hold what's going on with this sense that life is extremely difficult. And people really need care and compassion. So having this sort of benevolent attitude of wishing people well, often I see that little meme about, be kind to everyone. You don't know what sort of battles they're engaged in today. And I think that's also part of this heart of metta, of realizing that we're all struggling. And so being kind, wishing people well, having this kind of default setting of benevolence and friendliness, and just accepting that things are difficult for us all. And that, I think, is a very, is really a helpful default setting. And when it's when we teach it in the Theravadin tradition, it's usually taught as starting with oneself and then a benefactor, friends, family, a neutral stranger, and then onto someone more difficult. And it's the idea that these feelings should not be coerced; they should develop very, very naturally. And, since we're a caring species, we're primed to care about each other. Metta can arise really naturally. So we begin with those who are, sometimes it's more challenging for people to begin with themselves, and they might think of themselves at a time in the past when they could really have used support and just send these good wishes to that small person who was really adrift. And then you can send it to someone who just really inspires you. And it doesn't have to be someone you know. I do know people who, the Dalai Lama is their benefactor, or Jane Goodall, someone who just sort of inspires them with that sense of a life who exhibits that kind of kindness and care, so that we work with the benefactor, and then we could move out to family or friends if it seems natural. And often when people are doing very intensive metta retreats, Sharon Salzberg talks about working with the benefactor for a month, that all she did was work with the same person for a month. And she said she imagined that person in different period costumes, and she just really tried to keep it lively. But it's to really have a sense of that person's goodness. So we have a sense of our own goodness for having this aspiration of benevolence, benevolence and friendliness, and then we recognize it in another being. And sometimes I know people will use a pet or a child, and you just might want to adapt your whatever your metaphrases are. So may you be happy, may you be healthy, if you're may you live with ease if it's your pet. Whatever really cultivates that feeling of friendliness and warmth. And then when you've done, friends and family or whoever, if you are, if you're feeling that sense of wishing for others what you wish for yourself, you can try working with the familiar stranger or the neutral person. So that's someone you see but you don't really know. So it might be your postal carrier. When we went to gyms, it was someone you might see at the gym to check in with, or a cashier, or if you see someone regularly on a corner with a sign, you can just call that person's image to mind, and then just recognize that individual wants for themselves, to be safe, to be protected, to live in peace, and just offer it. Kamala often talks about, metta is just this beautiful offering of good wishes. It's sort of this act of friendliness. It is a very friendly gesture. And then ultimately, we can work with someone that we might have difficulties with. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit, moving to that. With loving kindness, sometimes people talk about a near enemy, something that looks like loving kindness, but isn't, just kind of masquerading. And it's usually attachment or expectation that we want something out of our offering, that we have an agenda in offering. May you be safe and protected. May you clean up your act. May you file your tax. We can just kind of go on and on with that agenda. And part of the offering is it's just this freely given wish for a person's contentment, happiness. And when metta encounters suffering, then it becomes compassion. So what characterizes loving kindness generally is just kind of a wish of wishing well that other people had for themselves what we would wish for ourselves, to be safe, protected, live in peace. And it's focusing on the goodness in our lives, the goodness in other people's lives. Now, may we live with equanimity. May we have appreciative joy. So when we meet someone who's suffering, our wish becomes for that suffering to, we recognize the suffering and we wish for that suffering to be alleviated, a wish for their liberation from suffering. And so it's not just empathy about the suffering. It's also in it is a wish to have the suffering alleviated. And that might just mean the person learning how to make peace with things as they are. But it's that move toward the good. So that's just something to note. And mudita, appreciative joy, is when we recognize, the good fortune of another, and we're happy for that person's good fortune. So we can really cultivate this quality to care for the welfare of all. And a lot of times when people are doing metta, they realize that they have this care for the natural world, this sort of kinship with the earth in a way. And they offer this aspiration for the ecosystem, for all living things to be well, for all living things to be sustained. It's kind of an unconditional regard for the welfare for others. Some people have said, it's impossible for all beings to live in harmony because beings have to eat each other. And that's true, but that still doesn't prevent us from having this aspiration, wishing that beings would live with some ease. And in this pandemic, this has been a time, I think, when we can really cultivate this aspiration for all persons to be healthy, for all persons to be protected. And this probably brings us to more about sort of the difficult person, because there's been a lot of anger, for example, about people who are not wearing masks. And, can you find it in your heart just to wish that person, may you be safe and protected, without being angry that person is choosing not to protect themselves or protect you? And if you can't, you can come back to yourself and offer metta to yourself about really recognizing how important it is for you to be safe and protected. And you just hold that, okay, so I really want to be safe and protected. And that's a perfectly ordinary, creaturely kind of wish. So the issue with metta, and this is often a little tricky in a way, is not to make it feel forced. So we can always come back, if we're not feeling benevolent, we can come back to our intention to develop that capacity, rather than gritting our teeth and saying, may you be safe and protected, when that's not really where our heart is. But come back to the fundamentals. And I've got this wonderful little aspiration by Larry Yang, who seems to capture this completely. I'll read it twice. He says, may I be as loving in this moment as possible. If I cannot be loving in this moment, may I be kind. If I cannot be kind, may I be non-judgmental. If I cannot be non-judgmental, may I not cause harm. And if I cannot not cause harm, may I cause the least amount of harm possible. I'll read that again. May I be as loving in this moment as possible. If I cannot be loving in this moment, may I be kind. If I cannot be kind, may I be non-judgmental. If I cannot be non-judgmental, may I not cause harm. And if I cannot not cause harm, may I cause the least amount of harm possible. Now, this seems to me really doable. It really is sort of at that basis of having a good intention, an intention of non-harming. And if you can't be loving, can you be kind? If you can't be kind, can you be non-judgmental? If you can't be non-judgmental, can you avoid harming? And if harm is inevitable, may it be the least amount of harm possible. You know, and as we see other beings, and these are sort of the difficult beings in our lives, either the difficult beings that we know personally or the difficult beings in public life, you know, we can see them as being shaped by causes and conditions. We can see them as this, you know, a product of many, this whole constellation of causes and conditions that have come about. And we can see them as afflicted with defilements. When we see cruelty, we can recognize that as an affliction of the mind that comes about because of causes and conditions. It's not that we condone it, but we can recognize that this is something that was caused. Recently, I read a very long article in the Atlantic about collaborators with dictators throughout history and with really terrible regimes. And they said, you know, it's really hard to know who is going to be the person who resists and who's the person who's going to collaborate. And Hannah Arendt wrote about this a long time ago. And she said sort of the way to protect yourself against that is to always recognize within yourself that you have the possibility to be a collaborator, that it is possible for you to do the evil about which you are now opposed, and that it was really by keeping that that alive. And the book, this article concluded with someone said, you know, it's about having this resolution to be a decent person all the time. The importance of being decent about the little things as well as the big things. And I don't know if that's much of a conclusion. I said, I don't know if that's it's not exactly uplifting, but it's not a totally depressing conclusion. But it seems that this sort of attention, and that's really where mindfulness fits into metta too, about really being aware of our intentions, seeing very, very clearly what's going on in the mind as we're offering metta too. Is there this sort of agenda? Is it something that is without substance? So I mean, it's as we've been talking about all these sorts of things, it really is a practice, and it seems to me that it's a kind of culmination of a lot of the things that we've been talking about, because it involves discernment and wisdom, and it's about seeing things clearly and still having that that open heart, that heart that doesn't close down, that heart that is able to see that all beings want to be safe and happy, although the ways in which they attempt to realize that are often really, really distorted. But you can still wish for people to be happy in the most fundamental and wholesome kind of state. So it's a wonderful, you know, sort of default state to wake up in the morning with a mind of friendliness, a mind of benevolence. And Kamala Masters talks about, you know, that as a kind of training to really cultivate that aspiration to have that as your kind of basic setting, this kind of just friendliness, or you might even say abandonment of ill will. Just, you know, years ago, I'm trying to remember this, if I can get this. So there used to be, you know, what was the bumper sticker about, no good act goes unpunished was one bumper sticker. And another bumper sticker is, you know, no act of kindness is ever wasted. And, you know, there may not be empirical evidence for one or the other, but you will be a much happier being if you have that sense of no act of kindness is ever wasted, rather than, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. Now, having that sort of cynical view, but saying, you know, no act of kindness is ever wasted. You never know when the seeds of your goodness are going to bring forth something. So we never know. So I really encourage you to practice with this. And you know, we can always reflect on our intention to cultivate it. Ruth King has a bracelet that she gives out that says, mindful of race, not there yet. And, you know, I think about that kind of mindful of metta, you know, not there yet, but this intention to really work with that, to be more a part of our, you know, our kind of default setting. So I'd be really interested in your comments or questions or thoughts about working with this. And just unmute yourself and jump in.
Yeah, Patrice, it's nice to see you. I was really interested to hear you talk about how sometimes metta can be a little bit tricky if you have an agenda. I did have that experience with myself when I was trying to do metta for myself a few months back, and I was really having a hard time emotionally. And I was trying to do metta for myself, and I was sort of having this sense of, like, I was like, you know, be well and feel better. It was like I was trying to make myself feel better. And luckily I kind of recognized that it didn't feel quite right. And then I switched to doing metta for other people. So I definitely experienced something like that.
And you can have, you know, you can feel a kind of tenderness for that part of you that wants to fix. You know, one of the most, sometimes I think about this, Ajahn Amaro once said, you know, the mind is like a committee, and it's got a rotating chair, and every so often, you know, the four-year-old gets the chair. And, you know, and we can think about, you know, parts of ourselves, and sometimes, or, you know, if we have a critical voice. So Sharon Salzberg says she calls her critical voice Lucy. Dan Harris calls his Robert Johnson. And when you're critical, you know, you're sort of fix yourself voice, you can just give that part of yourself a name and feel some tenderness for that part's good intentions to make things right. So you don't have to push that part away, but the other sort of wiser parts of yourself can just hold that that conditioning, that critical conditioning, with a kind of tenderness and affection and benevolence, and just realize that it's a condition. This is conditioned thoughts. And sort of let it play itself out. So we don't have to kind of scold ourselves for that sort of the fix it part of ourselves, but just again, bring that tenderness. Oh yeah, this is my conditioning, and feel that sort of kindness.
Thank you, Patrice. Yeah, I pulled out my Parami book, but I don't remember if it was Ajahn Sucitto or somebody. One of my teachers defined it also as the absence of ill will. If that's as far as you know, that's okay. And when I was having a very, I've always had a hard time with metta right from the get-go in the beginning, and especially with the self. And then, and I used to say someone told me, but I think it came to me, to be honest, to put myself in the difficult person category. And it really opened up a lot. Just the honesty of that, because there was something in my heart that was dishonest and trying to force the mind or heart a certain way. And then when I had a really traumatic experience with a Dharma teacher several years ago, someone told me in a difficult relationship or when there's been harm like that, not to force the heart to send metta to the person you label as the perpetrator in that moment, but to send metta to the situation.
Ah.
And that was, I've been working with that for a couple of years. I wanted to share, it's been so helpful. So when there was a breach with a family member, and it's just really raw, I'll send metta to the relationship. And it's not a hope that it'll be repaired. It's not any, it's just a radical acceptance of a tenderness of holding this relation. There's suffering here. You know, may it be healed, maybe be okay, whatever the outcome on the ground. And metta to the fact, the radical acceptance when something really, a horrible betrayal or a terrible loss, the situation or what we're, some of what we're experiencing in the world today. Mm-hmm. Can I send metta to the way things are? And it just, I don't know, it gave me a little bit of space to hold things that I initially feel are intolerable, you know, that there's something there. So I was wondering what your thoughts, if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, that's really beautiful. I often listen to a Dharma teacher who teaches in England, Zohar Lavi, and she has a talk called Metta to Phenomena. And it's about offering metta to, the sort of, right now that, you know, this huge encampment in Palo Alto and the difficulties of the situation, the difficulties for everybody involved, and just having a lot of tenderness toward that and caring. And I think that caring part, which is not so much, you know, in the Theravada they talk about sort of absence of ill will, but you know, it seems to me that it is that caring part that recognizes impermanence, that recognizes conditionality, this very mature part of us can have this kind of caring for extremely difficult situations. And next week when we talk about equanimity, it would be sort of metta infused with equanimity about sort of an impartiality about that. The other thing about having oneself as the difficult person, you know, one of the strategies in offering metta to a difficult person is to see if there's anything that you know that's good about this person. And you're usually when we do it, we start with someone who's just mildly annoying rather than the most difficult person in our lives. But, you know, I used to, years ago, I was with an organization, there was a board member, and we just seemed to butt heads every time we were in a meeting. And I just felt that he was, just made my life, miserable is too strong a word, but I always left meetings feeling really misseen or whatever. And so when I started doing metta for him, I just kept thinking, he is a great dad. As a board member, he was really difficult for me, but he was a great dad. He loved his kids. And I would just really reflect on what a great dad he was. And that, you know, when I thought about that, I thought, so, okay, so he's, he's really a difficult board member, but you know, it was really important that he was a great dad. So if when you're offering metta for yourself, if you are your own difficult person, you can think of it, is there a quality about yourself that you really appreciate? And, you know, it might be this quality of a kind of ruthless honesty, but that, you know, it's that quality that is trying to do good. So you can work with that. And my kind of ultimate fallback with people who are just extremely difficult, and these are mostly, you know, public figures, I just imagine them on their deathbed. I think we're all going to die. And this person may be really frightened at the time of death. And because I've been with people who've been dying, it's very painful to be with someone who is really frightened at the end. And, you know, in the Buddhist literature, there are all these stories of people who, you know, lived very, you know, not good lives, and the end is really a struggle for them. They don't die peacefully. So I reflect on that, and that sort of softens my heart toward that individual. So when we're trying to work with metta in this way, it really, you know, can use a lot of imagination between, you know, Sharon talking about, you know, dressing her friend up in different period costumes to offer metta for an extended period of time, to thinking about the good qualities of a person. Maybe to think that this person probably had a very unhappy childhood, or I knew someone who was very, very difficult, and I thought this person's taking care of a child who is severely compromised, needs tremendous care, you know, so this person was really, really a hard person to be around. But you know, I thought about that. This person cares for this severely disabled child. So, you know, if we can use our imaginations, you know, we can find that in our, we can open our hearts into not wanting them to suffer. Okay, so sort of abandoning ill will, which is not that we don't want justice, but we don't want them to suffer for the sake of suffering. And for people who have had, you know, who are the victims of sexual assault or something else, that may be so far down the road that, you know, that's a very distant possibility that working with metta is really just working about themselves and compassion for themselves. And it's not re-traumatizing people saying, and by the way, you know, we want you to get to the point where you're willing to, you know, let go of these feelings toward your perpetrator. I mean, that would be cruel. That would be a misuse of the teachings to try to set someone up to do that. But it can be an aspiration. Sometimes teachers say, yeah, it's an aspiration. If not in this lifetime, maybe in the next lifetime. So, you know, we work with this in ways that make sense for us, and it's really an ongoing exploration. Other thoughts?
Thank you.
Hi, I'd like to hear more discussion on tenderness and softness. I think it's something I often forget.
So we might, you know, again, we can say, so what makes us feel kind of warm? And this is, I know, Ajahn Suchito, who says, you know, something, oh, I think of kittens, which is just really kind of surprising that for, I don't know what I expect a monk to say, but but, you know, we can think of things that where we felt some sort of tenderness in the past or in present. And we just kind of support that, you know, and we see, so what are the conditions that bring around our feeling of caring? And it's that I think it's more when we feel a tenderness towards something. For me, there's often an implicit notion that I will do what I can to protect this. I mean, it's not kind of, you know, may all beings be happy, but, you know, when I'm, say, in a really beautiful place, and I think, and if I have an opportunity to protect this or to do something to support this, I will do this. It's just that kind of undertone feeling, and that we often have, you know, when we meet someone and we just have the sense, so if there's something I could do to help this person, I would do that. You know, it doesn't have to be anything dramatic, but it's a kind of engagement in the welfare of another, if that were possible. Is this making sense to people to say it in a sort of way? I haven't really articulated this before, but it is when I think about a kind of tenderness towards something, I do think of it as protective, maybe safe and protective, and that I would do what I could to support that that protectedness and safety. So I think that's what I mean by tenderness. Does that make sense to you?
It did at first, but then as you continued, it kind of put me in my head, and, you know, and I'm trying to understand and figure out how to, like, open more to my body. And, you know, with kindness, you know, with compassion. And when you started to talk, I thought about Michelle McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
She would use an image, and I don't know if it was specifically about loving kindness. It might have been about, like, a mom calf or a mom cow protecting her calf. Or, I mean, just imagining a tender scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm such a, you know, as a social worker, I'm like, my go-to is, you know, what can I do to make it better?
Mm-hmm.
And so that puts me in a whole nother place than opening to tenderness for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
I think it's especially when we think about sort of feeling tenderness toward our bodies, and if we've had a, you know, more, and I've certainly, you know, been in my head most of my life, and you know, it's more of a challenge to work with it. So I think it's just kind of a long-term aspiration, and it may be by thinking about how some bodies are kind to other bodies. You know, I mean, like watching a whole lot of little YouTubes of puppies playing, or the pandas, or, you know, a dog and a horse playing today, and yesterday a colt playing with a big ball, and, you know, watching things that just kind of evoke that, and just notice how that feels in your own body would be one way possibly of working with that. So
I hope that
helps.
Yes.
So we are just about out of time, and next week is our last week, and we'll be talking about equanimity. So I hope that will be interesting to you, and I really appreciate your participation this evening. So thank you all very much, and have a good week.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.